I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. New Year's can be a great time to set climate-friendly goals, like driving less, eating less meat, or saving energy at home. But even if you're excited about your resolutions on January 1st, following through for the rest of the year can be hard.
Things come in that challenge our motivation. So stress, difficult emotional situations, tiredness, all those things cause our motivation to weaken.
Ian Ballard, an assistant professor at the University of California, Riverside, studies how people make decisions and pursue goals. He says to make resolutions stick, break them into manageable steps and reward yourself for hitting milestones. For example, if you bike to work for a week, buy yourself a treat. He also suggests teaming up with a friend to work towards a shared goal, which can provide an extra boost to motivation and accountability. And he recommends making a plan for what to do if you're struggling to stay on track.
So it can be as simple as, if I fail to keep this resolution, then I'm going to set aside some time on a Sunday evening to think about how I can change the resolution and set a new goal going forward.
So instead of giving up, you can keep your commitment to climate action all year long. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
At the limit.
We lost the climate gamble. Now what? As the world hits record extreme cold and heat, even in December, leading scientists finally admit, so what comes after failure? From the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, you get the latest update in a full-length presentation by Professor James Dyke. First, a few notes on the estimates of what to expect this year and next in the climate casino. Yeah, welcome to an astonishing finish to 2025. North America is split into simultaneous extreme heat and cold. The lower 48 states easily broke the record for the warmest Christmas ever recorded by a margin of 5 degrees Fahrenheit, almost 3 degrees C. On Christmas Day, Denver, Colorado experienced a high of 71 degrees Fahrenheit, 22 C. It was summer-like t-shirt weather, a mile high, 1,600 meters into the mountains on Christmas. Dallas was 81 Fahrenheit. As America was roasting, not the turkey, but outside, our listeners in Canada's Yukon Territory continued their weeks of amazing cold. On December 23rd, Brayburn, Yukon recorded minus 55.7 C, that's minus 68 Fahrenheit. This is the coldest temperature recorded in December across Canada since 1975. The Yukon is about the size of Spain with a population of around 45,000 people. Most of them, about 33,000, live in the capital city of Whitehorse. Weeks of extreme cold make it dangerous to go outside with unprotected skin. To keep everyone and everything warm, including all the car block heaters and the pipes and all that, the past few weeks of extreme cold took the Yukon perilously close to its peak possible electrical loads. They hit the limits. On December 23rd, the government warned the population, saying, "We set an all-time peak demand record of 123 megawatts. This exceeded the previous record set just a few weeks ago. In ideal conditions, with everything running at maximum, our system can produce about 140 megawatts. The government is renting diesel generators to cope. A shout-out to freezing listeners in the Yukon. Radio EcoShock is broadcast there by CJUC 92.5 FM in Whitehorse and CFET in Tagish. A string of meteorologists and weather watchers are blown away by this huge contrast, over 150 degrees Fahrenheit or 83 degrees C on the same continent, without even counting the tropics. A similar split between excruciating cold and unseasonal heat is hovering between Siberia and Central Asia. These extremes are blamed on waves of the jet stream altered by climate change. We are setting up for an extreme future.
Go no further, no further to go. Speed and space, time and place. Got the limit.
So what should we expect in the next couple of years? Maps of the ocean temperature show very little warming in the southern hemisphere and definite cooling around the tropics and into the North Pacific and Atlantic Ocean. This follows 3 years of record-setting sea surface temperatures. Ocean surface temperatures are the main driver establishing what you and I experience on land. According to Carbon Brief, quote, in 2023, global temperatures reached a new high after they significantly exceeded expectations. This record was surpassed in 2024, the first year where average global temperatures were above 1.5 degrees C, above pre-industrial levels. Now, 2025 is set to be the second or third warmest year on record, end quote. At Berkeley, research scientist Zeke Hausfather neatly wraps up some predictions for 2026 and 27. The UK Met Office recently released their 2026 prediction, estimating that it is most likely to end up as the second warmest year on record at 1.46 C, with a range of about 1.34 C and 1.58 C. Relative, of course, to the 1850-1900 pre-industrial baseline. This is likely warmer than both 2023 and 2025, with a small chance of being warmer than 2024. Not to be outdone, James Hansen, the famous NASA scientist, released his estimate that 2026 temperatures will also be around 1.47 C, albeit using a somewhat different 1880 to 1920 baseline. Hansen also adds a prediction for 2027 at 1.7 degrees C of warming over pre-industrial, although he refers to the 12-month warming during the year rather than the annual average per se. The prediction is based on an assumed El Niño developing in late 2026, something that models have suggested is increasingly likely in recent weeks. So, folks, we must give up the idea that global warming is a steady escalator with record years, one right after the other, as you see on so many official graphs. The public could expect new records every year and weaken in their climate resolve if we encounter anything lower than that. People don't tend to pay attention if it's not a record, but it's still getting hotter. In November, respected European scientists James Dyke and Johan Rockström admit the world has lost the climate gamble. The safety line of 1.5 degrees C of warming is behind us. Following the new report, Living Beyond Limits, James Dyke laid it all out in a clear lecture December 10, 2025, at the University of Exeter in the UK. James is Assistant Director of the Global Systems Institute. Here it is.
So what were you doing here today? Well, I'm going to talk about a paper, but I'm going to ruthlessly editorialize this. So it was, as I will show you, it was a very large number of co-authors, but I'm going to tell you what they either do think or they should think about this paper. It was work that came out of the Earth League. The Earth League, it's an international collaboration of organizations. The University of Exeter, the Global Systems Institute, is a member. And we convened earlier this year in June in Hamburg, and it was reflecting on essentially 10 years since the Paris Agreement. So the Paris Agreement, 2015, it's its 10th anniversary coming up later this month, and it's a diverse community, and we wanted to consider, well, what has been the progress since the Paris Agreement, and what does that progress or lack of progress mean in terms of climate change and what's becoming increasingly commonly known as overshoot? So the title of the paper, Living Beyond Limits, Consequences I was very keen to get consequences in the title, right? Consequences of missing the decisive decade for preserving our planet's life-supporting systems. It's been 5 minutes to midnight for the last 30 years or so, right? And surely we can take the opportunity of 10 years after Paris and the imminent extinction of the available carbon budget for 1.5 to reflect on what has been a not just 10 years, but decades of failure. That's the paper that emerged, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. Subsequent to that, Johan and I wrote an article, a much shorter article for The Conversation. We don't write the title, but the editors thought the title of The World Lost the Climate Gamble, Now It Faces a Dangerous New Reality. And I will be talking about gambling and risk in some ways later, because I think at the heart of this issue is this notion of risk. Risk of what? How are we managing this risk? Okay, so some disclaimers. I do not represent the views of anybody else, certainly not my co-authors, or my institute or university. And of course, all errors and omissions are mine alone. So the talk summary, what am I going to tell you, right? Well, spoiler alert, we failed to stop the dangerous interference in the Earth system, and you know that already. But this failure has got consequences, and we are still working out what these consequences are going to be. I think in response of that, in response to that, the primary objective of climate research and policy is to manage these consequences. We can't live in la-la land anymore, this kind of fantastical bend the curve, everything's going to be fine, we're going to recover from overshoot. There are going to be very long-term and serious consequences of our failure to stop our dangerous interference in the climate system. One of those risks and the things that we're going to need to think about are what I call derailment risks, and I'll explain those later. And an associated risk is this kind of technocentric approach in further attempting to interfere with the Earth system, with the climate system. We could actually compound risks and make the situation potentially much, much worse. Okay, so the Paris talks in 2015. Yay, right? I don't know if anyone was around or engaged in climate advocacy or science at the moment. This was a very, very rare high point in which the international community in COP21, the 21st conference of the party, finally agreed what dangerous climate change was, and that it was well below 2 degrees Celsius, and that all nations would have a legal obligation to do whatever is required in order to limit warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius. Subsequent to that, I mean, I would argue in 2021 in Glasgow, well below has become understood as 1.5 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial periods. And there's a number of reasons why 1.5 is important. Back in the Paris Agreement 10 years ago, the narrative is that 1.5 is an existential risk to those people and places most vulnerable to climate change, low-lying island nation states, people who might live in river deltic areas that don't really have any credible form of adaptation from sea level rise, people in lower level or lower latitudes that will be subject to increasing severity of water insecurity or extreme weather events such as heat waves. Since then, however, we've had a decade of development of tipping point science, much of which has come out of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. And now I think it's fair to say that 1.5 represents potentially serious risk to some of the world's richest nations in terms of assets, in terms of liability, in terms of lost coastline, but then also in terms of morbidity and mortality. So 1.5 is important. It matters, right? Now, back in 2015, there were not any credible plans to actually completely decarbonize our societies. And there's a number of reasons for that. The polite society reason is that there will be some industries that are hard to decarbonize. There are no credible alternatives to burning kerosene in wide-body commercial aircraft at the moment. There are commercial electric aircraft, right? But there's nothing like the scale of the kerosene-burning fleet at the moment. So that's not going to be decarbonized in time. But then also you've got industrial processes, cement manufacturing, steel manufacturing, which while we can see how their emissions could be significantly reduced, there's no credible plan how we're going to turn these industries around at the pace of scale that we need in order to actually manage these carbon budgets for 1.5.
This is Radio EcoShock. You're listening to Dr. James Dyke, speaking at the University of Exeter on December 10th. The lecture is called Living Beyond Limits, following a new report of the same name.
So this is how I explain the origins of net zero. It is still the case that when we talk about climate policy, we talk about net zero. In fact, net zero has become synonymous with climate policy. 10 years ago, that wasn't the case, right? But now it's net zero. And what net zero is meant to do, it's meant to include not just carbon dioxide, but other greenhouse gas emissions, in particular methane, within science-based targets on emissions reductions, as opposed to relying solely on offsetting. But this idea that we reach net zero when essentially the amount of carbon we put into the Earth's atmosphere each year is balanced by the amount of carbon that we somehow remove each year. And that is driven by this notion of budgets. The amount of warming that we've got right now is, in some respects, a remarkably simple function of cumulative emissions since the large-scale burning of fossil fuels. And the more carbon dioxide we put into the Earth's atmosphere, the more warming we're going to see, because it increases radiative forcing. That carbon dioxide stays radiative active. It stays in the atmosphere for a very long time. So there's this kind of simple equation. You want to limit warming to a certain amount. You need to limit the amount of total carbon cumulative emissions. And that ends up producing a carbon budget. So here's a little animation courtesy of the Global Carbon Budget. Gosh, that's another Global Systems Institute project that I've just mentioned. It's titled Time is Up for Staying Below 1.5, because there's kind of a simple arithmetic that as the years go by and the cumulative emissions increase, which produces an increase in the average surface temperature of the Earth, you end up reaching a point when essentially that budget is gone. And now we estimate it to be about, 6% left, and it could be exceeded within, let's say, 4 years. Well, it depends on who you ask. I'm not going to talk too much around some of the competing theories around the what appears to be acceleration in the rate of warming. Maybe I will, just to upset Peter, who sat at the back. But what we can say definitively is that carbon budget is nearly gone. So here's some work from Piers et al. Earlier this year reflecting on carbon budgets. They estimate the 50% carbon budget is going to be exhausted in 28. It's worth bearing in mind that previous IPCC assessment reports, they didn't give 50% probabilities. It was like 66, 2 and 3. For a 66% chance of limiting warming to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius, you won't really see those budgets reported anymore because they're not policy relevant, because the carbon budget would be exhausted probably within a matter of months now. So now we're back to 50%. And when 50% is gone, then I guess we could go to 40% or 30% or 25%. There are still significant uncertainties with regards to the climate's response to our radiative forcing. And let's remember, we need to put this into context, into a wider context. Here we've got 10,000 years of carbon dioxide as reported by Berkeley Earth, and it's this spike since large-scale industrial processes. What is it? 2.5 trillion tons, over 2.5 trillion tons of carbon dioxide that we have put into the Earth's atmosphere since industrial processes. But over half of that has been emitted since 1990, right? So since the UNFCCC started in earnest, since COP1. So over half the cumulative emissions we put into the atmosphere has happened on the watch of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that almost entirely, along with natural variation, which you've got a reasonably good understanding of, accounts for the increase in global temperature anomaly. Berkeley Earth last year had it exceeding 1.5. It's actually 1.6 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial periods. This does not mean that global warming has exceeded 1.5 or 1.6, because you need a longer baseline. You need 20 years to really zero out natural variability in order. You need to zero out that natural variability to be able to detect the long-term trend. But with both the increase in surface temperatures and the vanishing carbon budget, I don't think there's really any doubt that 1.5 is gone. But I did mention earlier that the rate of climate change or global warming has been increasing over the last 10 years. This is from an article from Carbon Brief. I think it was last year that they did a special on this. Zeke contributed, a whole bunch of other climate scientists contributed. And it was kind of this discussing, well, you know, for a while, some people, most notably Jim Hansen, previous director of NASA Goddard, has been arguing that the rate of increase of temperatures is much faster. It's been accelerating. It's maybe even up to twice as fast as previous decades. And why is that? And there's been a whole bunch of competing theories and arguments, even dispute that this is a statistically significant signal. And it is absolutely the case that we would need longer in order to determine if that was the case. But I think it's fair to say that there is increasing consensus that the reduction in aerosol load, aerosol forcing, the reduction in high sulfur content burning coal and maybe even marine shipping could have been reduced the global dimming effect that we have inadvertently been producing on the climate, and therefore, in some respects, unmasking the amount of radiative forcing we're producing through greenhouse gases. And Jim calls it this kind of Faustian bargain that we've been playing with the climate system. Jim is also much more hawkish on climate sensitivity. So when you add in that factor, and when you add in the factor that Jim tends to not be very polite about contemporary climate modelling, I think it's fair to say, he bases his assessments much more on kind of paleo data, on historical data. When you do that, then his assessment of the actual amount of warming that we've got, given cumulative emissions, is much, much higher than you would see in, let's say, even in like the CMIP 6 models. Anyway, back to one side. I would argue you don't need Jim to be right to be freaking out. You don't need Jim to be correct about aerosols and acceleration for us to conclude that 1.5 is gone and serious consequences are in the pipeline. And just to remind us that an average increase of 1.5 or 1.6 degrees Celsius a year above that in terms of pre-industrial periods means potentially very significant annual temperature anomalies up to 5-6 degrees Celsius. And you see most of this in the higher latitudes, a process called Arctic amplification. And also Europe, which is pretty much the fastest warming continent for reasons, which are kind of interesting and I don't entirely understand them. But these are average anomalies. And of course, the concerns that we've got about climate change is not changes in averages, but the changes in extremes. So these averages, average anomalies are being driven by, in some places, extremely high temperatures. So the 1.5 budget is gone. I know there was an awful lot of scepticism at the time that 1.5 was ever credible given existing political realities, let's say, given existing political, maybe even economic systems. But this showed for a 66% chance. This is from Robbie's work back after the Paris Agreement kind of was being agreed, even for a 66% chance, you'd see the longer that you leave it, the more and more heroic your rates of mitigation become. Put, let's say, 4% reductions into kind of context. During COVID lockdowns, there was periods in which global emissions were being reduced at a rate of maybe 6 or 7% or something. So in order to produce anything like the rate of change required for 1.5, you'd have to be either shuttering significant regions of the global economy or doing something else quite radical to our industrialized societies. But 1.5 is still alive, right? That's what you hear. That's every COP you go to. That's what we say. We've got to stay the course. The Paris Agreement hasn't failed. We can still limit warming to 1.5. That's because net zero is transitioning to overshoot. So I say here that net zero relies on overshoot. Net zero, 1.5 relies on overshoot. 1.5 has always relied on overshoot. There's always been this understanding within the Paris Agreement that we're going to exceed 1.5, but then hopefully temperatures will be dragged back down by the end of the century. And they're going to do that because around 2050, when we reach net zero, we're going to transition to a period of net negative. So we're going to be removing more and more carbon dioxide from the Earth's atmosphere than we put into it. And in doing so, reduce cumulative emissions and therefore reduce warming. And I will talk a little bit more about that. I don't want to talk too much about it because I've talked about it an awful lot in the past. But let's just take a moment to reflect on where we are right now. There are lots of people who don't think climate change is real, for a whole bunch of probably motivated reasons, right? Ask the insurance industry, they'll tell you, because these are the people, these are the organizations on the hook for paying for climate-related extreme weather impact events. $162 billion this year. Climate catastrophes are creating a new market reality for insurance carriers. One way to interpret that is that there will be some places which become literally uninsurable because the premiums cannot be afforded. No insurer wants to take that risk. Costs pile up as climate change adds $600 billion in insurance losses. We see rising heat deaths. This is one of the easier ways to determine climate change impacts on morbidity and mortality, because the warmer it gets, the more likely you're going to get extreme weather events such as lethal heat waves. So the rate of heat-related mortality has increased by nearly a quarter since the 1990s. We're seeing increasing wildfire and drought impacts, and that is having a non-trivial impact on economic strain. Productivity losses equivalent to maybe $1 trillion. The costs of heat-related deaths among adults reaching $261 billion. This is safe climate change. This is acceptable climate change. This is the decision that society, through its either elected politicians or the politicians that come to govern those systems or nation states, have determined is acceptable in the context of how much greenhouse gases can be put into the atmosphere to produce this amount of warming. And none of this should be a surprise. There is, I think, quite compelling work that in many respects we have potentially seriously underestimated the distribution of risks and therefore how much economic loss, how much morbidity or mortality might be in the pipeline. But these numbers, in some respects, shouldn't surprise anyone. This is just the unavoidable consequence of living in a climate system which has become significantly warm over a geologically instant timescale. Yes, the climate's changed a lot in the past. You know, we've got 3.8 billion years of history of life on Earth, and some of the most intense mass extinction events have been associated with climate change, but probably nothing like this has happened in terms of radiative forcing, either for millions and millions of years or perhaps even ever, right? So this is really exceptional. So we're transitioning from net zero into overshoot. And yes, maybe Paris Agreement was always about overshoot, because you would never have gotten the United States, you would have never gotten even the United Kingdom, which is meant to be a progressive, forward-thinking climate nation, to agree to doing the things that would really have been required to manage the carbon budget for 1.5 or even below 2 degrees Celsius in 2015. The United States would never have signed up for the required rapid decarbonisation. So it was all about on-ramps. We could offset through nature-based solutions, forests, carbon sinks. We can invoke technologies, carbon capture, storage, carbon dioxide removal. We can kind of taper the curve such that we will arrive at a safe place after we've overshot by a bit down by the end of the century. So the architects of the Paris Agreement were extremely clever on how they crafted that agreement. And I'm extraordinarily grateful for their efforts in being able to produce what has been still humanity's best efforts at avoiding dangerous climate change. But how are we going to do that, right? How are we going to drag temperatures back down? Well, I call it the wacky races. If you've got an idea to remove a large amount of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, then you just go knock like a philanthropic fund and they might give you, I don't know, a few million or something. And yes, that does sound incredibly bitter, because I tried it myself and it has not worked yet. But how would they do that? So there's a number of different ranges and approaches. On the top here, we've got so-called nature-based solutions, some of which just seem to be little regrets options. They seem to be generally good ideas. Let's take biochar. You take agricultural waste, farm waste, the waste that's left over from, let's say, threshing wheat or something, and you turn it into charcoal, process of pyrolysis, locks up that carbon in that biomass, and then you can put that biomass high in carbon back on the land to increase productivity and locks a significant amount of carbon up. You can undergo tree planting. This could be reforestation, so planting trees which used to exist through a process of maybe habitat restoration, or afforestation, where you plant very large areas with typically fast-growing alien species, which might not be very good for biodiversity. You can reduce the pH of the ocean, reduce carbon dioxide concentrations directly in the ocean. And taking carbon dioxide directly out of the sea, that doesn't seem to be a tremendously bad idea either. You can accelerate the silicate weathering cycle by essentially grinding up mountains and then spreading those minerals on crop fields, which would accelerate the kind of natural process in which carbon dioxide reacts with water to produce weak acids, which then react with the minerals to lock up carbon dioxide. You could undertake ocean fertilization, which has been attempted badly in the past and not gone very well. But the idea of overcome nutrient limitation in the top portions of the ocean that would produce algal blooms, which when they die would